Friday, gold rebounded from oversold conditions as investors fled equities amid a looming default in South America. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, with another oversized episode for you this weekend. It's great to be back with you with top interviews from leading market professionals, as well as the business headlines affecting your portfolio. Well, the head of Euro-Pacific Capital, Peter Schiff, says Wall Street is perplexed by the gold rebound this year. The nascent domestic economic and housing recovery may only be smoke and mirrors, and that's bad news for Fed officials who have based their forecasts on continued demand for residential real estate. The HGX Housing Index dropped to the lowest point in over 7 months, registering no forward progress in a year. The net result could be renewed interest in inflation hedges, which could catapult the precious metal sector to levels not seen in years. Next at the plate, professional real estate manager Fabian Calvo returns to the show. He says top real estate hedge funds have access to virtually free loans. This allows them to purchase millions of foreclosed homes at fire sale prices, making it difficult for the rest of us. But eventually, the entire housing bubble 2.0 could come crashing down, potentially sending precious metals sky high. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather report. Well, gold and silver performed well this week relative to the equities markets, at least on Friday. Gold rebounded sharply from oversold conditions amid a possible Argentine debt default. Investors sought cover first in U.S. dollars and later in gold. At Friday's closing bell in the New York COMEX Exchange, gold was off only about 13, ending just shy of 1,300 an ounce. Higher for the year by still about 5-6%. Silver gave back less than half a dollar, finishing well above $20 an ounce. Palladium dropped 14, closing at 866, and platinum also gave back about 17, ending at 1466 an ounce. West Texas Intermediate crude plunged $4, ending at 97.62 a barrel. Well, the top story influencing the market this week was arguably the Federal Reserve. The latest FOMC meeting, Fed officials held the overnight benchmark rate low, but they did agree to taper those toxic mortgage-backed securities and treasury purchases for the sixth consecutive meeting, dropping the monthly buying spree to only $25 billion. Plus, according to the Labor Department, non-farm domestic payrolls climbed by 209,000 in July. However, the unemployment rate did climb by 1% unexpectedly to 6.2% in the latest reading. The U.S. economy added, as I mentioned, jobs, marking the sixth straight month of 200,000-plus gains. That's the best performance in over 15 years. Well, the news helped gold to rebound a bit from oversold conditions on expectations of possible Fed easing, as well as news that Argentina could be entering default. The Argentine economic minister called it atomic nonsense to say that the country had entered into default. Nevertheless, many sources are claiming that the country is in early default mode. Argentina has been battling a group of hedge funds, reportedly, who have sued the country for full payment of $1.5 billion on bonds that the country defaulted on way back in 2001. Bottom line on the precious metals sector. Well, the summer months tend to be a bit slow for this sector, but soon jewelry demand ahead of the holidays is likely to pick up, as well as jitters in South America and other geopolitical concerns. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. Investors were disappointed over the Fed's lack of support at this week's FOMC meeting, especially given the global equities downdraft thanks to the South American debt situation. For the week, the Dow was off nearly 470 points. The S&P 500 dropped 53, wrapping up at 1925, while the NASDAQ fell almost 100 points, ending at 4324. Although word on the street suggests that traders sold shares on the stronger-than-expected unemployment report, the upbeat reading masked an underlying problem, and that's clearly the increase in the unemployment rate. Plus, weaker than expected corporate earnings have disappointed investors who essentially had factored in a near perfect world scenario, leaving little wiggle room for disappointing numbers. The lack of orchestrated efforts as well from the Fed, ECB, BOJ, and related global central bankers, I think, left few positives to encourage bulls to hold on to their positions over the weekend. The European indices were also hard hit this week, with the Stoxx Europe 600 off nearly 2% for the month and the DAX off about 4.3%. Its worst monthly showing in 2 years. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our seven-component sentiment index pendulum finally has swung into the extreme fearful category, and this is one of the most fearful numbers we've seen in over 3 years. It's clearly a positive, but we're going to have to keep an eye on this day by day. But for the rest of next week's reports and all of the stock candidates, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. We actually had a couple of solid performers this week, despite the downdraft of one of which, of course, was a gold equity. So please log in. If you haven't signed up, we'd be glad to have you on board with us. And coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Peter Schiff from Europacific and Fabian Calvo. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Fabian Calvo manages millions of dollars of distressed mortgages, and he can be found at thenotehouse.us. Welcome, Fabian Calvo.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
It's great to have you back. And I wanted to start off today. We were talking before the show about what you're terming the real estate consolidation. Give us an idea. Is this the calm before the storm, or are we going to have another leg higher, and then comes the big drop?
Yeah, well, I certainly think another leg higher. This has basically been a stated investment policy, if you will, by the Blackstones and America Home for Rent and the Colony Capitals, which are these gigantic hedge funds that are getting billions and billions of dollars in 0.005% loans to basically gobble up housing. Distressed housing across the country, not just distressed. What you're seeing is a lot of the much smaller private equity funds or smaller hedge funds that have built up decent-sized real estate portfolios, those are now being gobbled up by these big, big players. And so what they've called it is the consolidation phase. And what, you know, my sources tell me, what, you know, just in my dealings with, you know, being on the front lines of this market, Chris, is that basically this is all being built up in order for this last big leg up in basically making loans out to unsuspecting borrowers, most of them being subprime, to get them into these homes with new debt that will ultimately be backed by government sponsored agencies, or, you know, whether it's Fannie Mae, the U.S. government, whoever it is. All of them have a key role to play in this dumping of real estate that's been acquired since 2009, 2010.
You know, the numbers really back up this idea. And, you know, I was talking to Peter Schiff this week. He'll be on the show with you. The only really solid buying going on right now in the U.S. is coming from these hedge funds and other institutions that are packaging up huge numbers of distressed and foreclosed homes. John and Jane Q. Public, they just can't get the mortgages. They're having trouble. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. They're having trouble. This is why you have everywhere from, you know, the new Fannie director, Mal Watts, who was basically caucusing with the socialist Democrats in Congress prior to being appointed to run Fannie by Obama. From him all the way to Wells Fargo, all these different big institutions talking about the need for subprime to tap into this huge market of people who want to buy a home. They just don't have the down payment nor the credit score to buy the home. You know, this next bubble is going to look different than the one in 08, where you basically can walk into any bank. If you had a pulse, you'd get a loan. Those loans are mostly going to come by these big Wall Street mega institutions, mega hedge funds, who really are, in essence, almost proxies or backed by the Goldman Sachs, the J.P. Morgans of the world. And they're going to do their loans in a couple different ways. We spoke about this last time I was on, through something called a land contract. But also, they will likely You know, you could very well see Blackstone come out with their own, you know, lending wing, as we've seen with Colony Capital. They now have basically or Skyline Capital. They're starting to basically say, all right, well, let's just set up a mortgage division, and we'll just do the loans to these people, and then we'll bundle them up, and we'll sell them to whoever it is. And so that's how they're going to basically get around, you know, almost try to kind of go behind enemy lines, if you will, Chris, and hide that they're fueling this bubble, because for sure the media will be playing this up as this is a bona fide housing recovery when it's nothing but a huge manipulated Ponzi scheme.
I'm assuming then that when this pumping continues, that it's going to put some more downward pressure on other asset classes, or will this just lift everything up? Will the tide lift all the boats along with it?
Well, certainly. I mean, we've seen, you know, last month, I believe it was revealed, something that I think listeners of this show definitely know, that the central banks around the world have pumped in trillions into the global equities market. Well, basically the same thing is happening with real estate. It's happening, quite frankly, with a multi-bubble, with these multiple bubbles we've seen, from the dollar bubble, the bond bubble. And so I think that you're going to see all of these, particularly the stock market and real estate bubble, continue to go up. I mean, since March of 2012, I believe it was, 2012, the housing is up over 20%. And I think we're going to continue to see that at least for the next 12, possibly 24 months, because I keep saying that the next leg down isn't just going to be isolated to housing or stocks. It's going to be the bursting of the multi-bubble U.S. economy, and it's likely going to center around the biggest bubble, which is the dollar bubble.
Now, that's what I wanted to get to, the greenback, the U.S. dollar. So if we're talking about everything coming down, and then you're going to see this dollar that's been bouncing around a bottom here for, it's got to be 3 or 4 years, making no headway. Every time it looks like it's going to break out and recover, it falls right back down. So if we're talking about a falling dollar, that's always good news for the precious metals. Tell us more.
Well, I think that, you know, for sure you see, you know, I think it was Andrew McGuire just the other day was interviewed with that. Andrew McGuire being the gentleman who exposed J.P. Morgan's manipulation of the silver market.
And he and his, I think, fiance were run off the road just after they testified. It was quite a big deal.
Right. So they tried to kill him. And, you know, this goes back to these so-called banker suicides, where I think that they're scared to death of any real whistleblower, real economic Edward Snowden, that revealed the frauds that are taking place. And so, you know, he was talking about how he's seen the record levels. I mean, hundreds of tons, or, you know, I believe the number was hundreds of tons of gold being purchased by Eastern economies, likely much of that coming from China. And I think those countries recognize that if they continue with the U.S. dollar, global U.S. dollar system that's been set up, it's a losing proposition for their country and for the people in their country, and could potentially lead to revolution in their country with inflation, you know, running 200% plus in China over the last 10 years. So, you know, a lot of these emerging economies that are starting to have more influence coming to the realization that if we join together, we could be a real alternative to the U.S. dollar. And we see this with, you know, the BRIC nations starting this new version of their IMF and the World Bank. But it's not just these emerging economies, Chris. I think you have a lot of European economies, especially Germany, are beginning to realize, and not only realize, they're being intimidated and bullied by the U.S. to keep up with this dollar policy. I mean, in the last month, we've seen the U.S. government go after BNP, the French bank, for wanting to send some warships to Russia. We've seen them ruffle feathers wanting to go after Deutsche Bank, claiming that they're doing shady dealings. I mean, the shady dealings are epic on Wall Street, but of course, they're not going after those banks. They're going after European banks. I would suspect European banks that are getting too cozy to the notion of bilateral trade agreements with the Chinese, or just alternatives to the U.S. dollar. And I think that those countries, if those countries ultimately take the switch and say, look, we think the dollar as a world reserve currency is outdated, we think it should be more opened up, we should have other, we should be able to do bilateral trade with whoever we want. You know, those are the type of real economic shocks that I think will send real shockwaves with the U.S. dollar globally.
Okay, so again, this sounds like good news then for the precious metals. Are you looking for opportunities to accumulate any of the mining shares or bullion, physical bullion?
Gold. I buy gold and silver monthly. I have for years now. And I'm just a big believer that when what I call the global economic reset takes place, things will go back to gold and silver. Now, that could look like a variety of different ways. It could mean you actually use gold and silver to conduct trade, but I think the dollar will still be in existence. It's just, what's it going to be worth? At least for me, gold and silver isn't so much of an investment as it is an insurance policy against a currency that I know not only is A, being completely devalued, Chris, but just the track record of fiat currencies in general, we know is not a good one.
That's quite an understatement there. And, for the most part, we've just watched fractional banking simply decimate the purchasing power of almost every currency. We look at the U.S. dollar over this 100-year track record from the Federal Reserve, the creature from Jekyll Island. We've lost, as I'm sure you know, somewhere around 96% to 97% of the value. But you know what happened so gradually? Apparently, we're not supposed to notice. Unfortunately, you're talking about a scenario, and an interesting one that many people have brought up, where we could see a sudden reset. Take a look at South America. I mean, we just recently seen Argentina once again having trouble with its currency. Gold actually skyrocketing 70 to 80% in just a brief period of time there for anybody who was lucky enough to divest their local currency into the precious metals. Any other topics on the itinerary today?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big thing to be looking at is these new sanctions being imposed by the West on the Russians, in essence, creating currency and trade wars with the Russians. Interestingly enough, you mentioned the 100 years of the Fed. Well, yesterday was the 100-year anniversary of the beginning of World War One, and, you know, we know one of the things that led to that was just complete incompetence and, you know, lack of any real leadership. And also, coupled with that was all of these different treaties to defend each country if one of them was attacked or went to war. Well, we have that same exact system set up today. I mean, it's almost a mirror image of what it was 100 years ago. And, you know, the more I see the real fault lines in the Western economy, and really just, I can't, you know, I the more that I really think is that these people, and they understand that if they pull the trigger on the reset now and the economy enters a depression, that's bad enough. However, if they can simultaneously start a greater regional war, get people's minds off of it, or to use as the reason behind why the economy has suddenly collapsed, well, that they can sell that likely to an unsuspecting public a little bit better.
You are absolutely right. According to the sources I've been following for decades, these folks are agent provocateurs, are by their very job title doing just that. I mean, they are there to disrupt the economies. I mean we've had some great folks on the show. We had the economic hitman himself, you know, Mr. Perkins, right here on the show outlining just what he did. Everyone's ambivalent about this Ukraine-Russia drama. To them, I think they just see it as a sideshow. Oh, it's way over there. They're missing, I think, some big pieces to this puzzle. Firstly, the UK Telegraph has made it clear in no uncertain terms that we are looking at another Cold War here. And that's why I think you have absolutely honed in on an important point. You're looking at a region that is the breadbasket for much of the world. We used to be, now it's Ukraine. They also have an incredible natural gas resources, and then they have all the pipelines running through there, not to mention all of the electricity that flows from Moscow right through Ukraine. This is a huge hotbed, and I like your parallel. I think it's apt with World War One, Archduke Ferdinand. Now Putin, as I'm sure you read, just got a food taster because of the poisonings going on there. His plane, there was an attack on his plane. This is a powder keg. Tell us more.
Well, I mean, definitely. With respect to Putin, I mean, I've heard from a few of my sources, and this isn't anything that they've verified. This is just people's opinions, but these are people who, you know, are in the inner workings, particularly of finance, telling me that they wouldn't be surprised, and I got to say, I disagree with this, but that they wouldn't be surprised to see the oligarchs trying to basically kill Putin. And I think the fact that you mentioned the food taster, the fact that it was discussed or revealed that the MH17 flight that was shot down was potentially following the same flight path as Putin's plane. You know, that could be a possibility. If people believe the notion that, you know, the oligarchs only care about money, they'll take out Putin, they'll get Kozy back up to the West, so they could continue to come to America and basically buy their $80 million New York penthouses. Well, I personally disagree with that for many reasons. And one is that Palin spent the last 10 years stacking the deck with real loyalists, not just within government, but within basically major industries in Russia. So I don't think they're going to try to take him out. I think that if he is killed for whatever reason, that's going to be some kind of job that happens from, you know, the CIA, MI6, the Mossad, something like that. People need to understand that in the Ukraine, especially where the so-called separatists are fighting the Ukrainian government, it's a major area of shale gas. And Putin's not going to allow the Ukrainian government to go in, take that over, and then be the primary exporter of natural gas to Europe. He's just not going to let that happen. And I think that with these sanctions that have been levied against Russia, it's only going to make the Russian bear, who is cornered now, acting more aggressively. So here's a couple things that I think we could potentially see in the next coming months. I would not be surprised if Putin comes out and openly invades the eastern Ukrainian region. He'll do it under the premise of something like a peace type of plan or a peace mission. He just wants to really restore peace and help the separatists that are being slaughtered. Because the truth is, nobody, Chris, will try to stop him. Nobody will. So I think we can easily see that. I also think we could easily see Putin go to the Iranians and say, look, this deal that you're trying to strike with them completely sucks. I will help you get the nuclear weapons that you want, and maybe even do some kind of alliance that involves protecting them if they're attacked or invaded by the Israelis or anybody else. And, you know, this is what's important to understand is that we live in a world today that isn't going to continue to function the way the world worked for your parents or grandparents. It's out-of-the-box thinking that typically comes to manifest itself. And so these are things that I look around. I talk to a lot of intelligent people, as you do as well. And, you know, there are things that most of the time things happen in a way we never expected. And I think that those two scenarios are very probable between now and the end of the year.
No, exactly. I mean, we're seeing the market support this idea. I mean, look at platinum and palladium. Russia, number one producer of one and second largest producer of the other. Of course, the prices are substantially higher than the other precious metals out there. And this is because the market is putting a premium on the fact that Russia is going to continue curtailing these essential exports, and some of them, you know, military as well as industrial. So, I mean, we're seeing people put money behind the idea. And, you know, we can discuss geopolitical concepts all day long, but as you say, it's that forward thinking that's going to help our listeners.
Yeah, you know, I'll just make one more quick point, Chris, is that this isn't also, you know, a lot of people are calling this Cold War 2.0. This isn't the Cold War, the past Cold War we had with the Russians. In America, where there was really this Pax Americana, where Europe, really the rest of the world, just followed America. And if they didn't follow America, they knew I better not mess with them because they're, you know, they're going to take me out or whatever's going to happen. The world has really changed. And I think, you know, it's almost like that story of the emperor has no clothing. And that's what's happened with America. And it's not because of the American people. It's because of the shysters that have come in to take over the American Republic. And now they're running it, and their masters are the big Wall Street banks. And so it's a completely separate agenda, a completely separate country than it was in the first Cold War. And so the rest of the world realizes that, Chris, and they realize that, look at how many times just in the last couple of years, America's literally been on the wrong side, whether it was supporting the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or it was taking out, you know, Gaddafi in Libya, you know, giving Libya over to Al-Qaeda. I think the rest of the world is catching on to this, and I think they're making contingency plans that are in stark contrast with how I think the bureaucrats in Washington think that they think the world will work.
I mean, we're talking about the special interests, the banks, the bankers. They have an incredible lobby on Capitol Hill. And these people on the inside say you are either with the lobbyists or your idea, your program is dead. It's shut. You don't have a chance. You won't get reelected. You'll suddenly see your funds just disappear.
Oh, well, you know, I think that it's definitely interesting times that we're living in, and I would urge people to you know, do their best to become self-reliant and recognize that, you know, I'm not saying this will happen next week, but it could happen next week, next year, 5 years from now. But I think the world's on the precipice of fundamental change. And I think those of us that realize that, that are out-of-the-box thinkers, people, you know, people like the listeners of Gold Seek Radio, Chris, I think we'll be the ones that ultimately will be able to, you know, weather the storm and really be instrumental in the reset of what the future America looks like.
I hope you're right, but if we don't wake up enough folks, you know, you can have that life raft, but if there's, 100, 200, 300 million people grasping around in the waters, they might take you down with them. So let's keep getting the word out here, and Fabian, tell folks how they can find out more about what you're doing.
Yeah, they can always go for my real estate business. They can always go to thenodehouse.us, or for my commentary on entrepreneurship, economics, and geopolitics, they could check out FabianForLiberty.com, FabianForLiberty.com.
Fabian Calvo, keep up the great work.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Well, Peter Schiff, President and Chief Global Strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital. Welcome, Peter Schiff.
Thanks for welcoming me back.
It's great to have you back. And I wanted to ask you a few questions here on some comments you've made regarding gold's rise this year. You say it's kind of thrown off Wall Street. The major bankers are somewhat perplexed. They've told their clients to sell. Even Goldman, which has, I think, one of the better track records, which may not be saying much, you know, not very sanguine on gold's prospects. Tell us more, please.
In fact, you know, I was in an interview on CNBC.com earlier today, and before I was on, former Congressman Ron Paul was on, and they asked him about gold, and they said, the announcer said, gold's had a very rough year so far in 2014. You know, you've been bullish on gold. What do you make of the market? Now, this is a CNBC anchor saying that gold has had a rough year so far in 2014. Gold is up about 8% on the year. It's up more than the stock market. So by what definition did gold have a tough year? Unless you're saying that, well, it wasn't up 20%, it was only up 8%. Maybe that's the definition of tough, but why don't they apply the same definition to the stock market? Because if the stock market's up 3 or 4% on the year, it's a great year. But gold's up 8% and it's having a tough year. So you know, they don't really cover it fairly. Meanwhile, everybody was expecting the stock market to be up this year. In fact, it's up less than all the experts thought it would be, whereas those same experts expected gold to be way down on the year. Instead, it's doing better than the stock market. And they don't even acknowledge how wrong they were. They still pretend that they're right.
No, exactly. They report the news after the news. You know, the Dow has broken through the 17,000 mark, and I think this is what they're really focusing on, isn't it? They're looking at the new highs as gold as the bull market of the past, of 2011. What's going to take gold back to its former highs in the next couple of years?
Well, I think it's just going to be the continuation of the trend that's been in place really since 1999, 2000. It's been the Fed keeping rates too low, creating too much inflation, which has been driving the gold market. And it's not just our central bank. It's central banks in Europe. It's central banks in Asia. All over the world, there's all this money printing. They're not mining nearly as much gold as the money that's being printed. So the price of gold is going to continue to go up. Yeah, we've had one down year. I mean, since 2000, gold's had one down year. And to hear all the experts talk about gold, you'd think it was down every year but one. And, you know, they make fun of me. They say, well, Peter Schiff, you know, you're always saying gold's going to go up. I say, yeah, and it always has. I mean, ever since I've been talking about gold for the last 13, 14 years, I've been right every year except one. You know, and the reason I keep saying it's going to go up is because I know the likelihood is that it's going to go up in any given year. It doesn't mean it will go up every year. Maybe gold will go up, you know, over the next 14 years. Maybe it'll have another down year, but maybe it'll have 12 up years. I don't know when the down year is going to happen, so I'm not going to bet on a down year in an uptrend, especially when I know it's got a long way to go. But, you know, the people that seem to catch a lot of, you know, they get a break are the people that are always negative on gold. Somehow they're the geniuses, the ones that have been saying every year, don't buy gold, it's going to go down. All of a sudden, they're stars because it went down in 2013. You know, they're wrong for a dozen years in a row, and then finally, these guys know what they're talking about. They said gold was going to go down, yeah, and they said it would be down in 2014. All the people that predicted gold would go down in 2013. They also predicted it would go down in 2014, and they've been wrong.
You know, another component, I think, to this story that people are missing, at least in the mainstream, is that we've seen money flowing from around the world, scared money, particularly from Eastern Europe, where there's a lot of trouble in the Middle East. There's very little safe havens other than the perceived U.S. stock market. They don't want to miss what they see as an opportunity. But, you know, that is oftentimes the sign of frothiness, that the trend could reverse course. That's going to make gold, precious metals, commodities, crude oil much more attractive. Tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I think that commodity prices in general are going to outpace U.S. stock prices. But there are a lot of stock markets around the world. That's, you know, the stocks that we are investing in at Euro Pacific Capital, the ones we're buying for clients in our funds. That's where we find real value. And I think the key is to try to avoid the enormous losses that are in the future, particularly for holders of paper money and these overvalued, over-leveraged, hyped-up stocks. I mean, not all stocks fit into that category, but there certainly are a lot of stocks that are trading at nosebleed valuations, similar to what we had in the dot-com bubble. But more importantly, that the overall bubble that underlies the U.S. economy is even bigger now than it was then. And I think it's interesting that you're having people debate whether or not the Fed potentially will keep interest rates too low too long and maybe inflate another bubble when that's already happened. You know, there was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend by the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas speculating that maybe if the Fed doesn't, you know, doesn't stop the stimulus, there's a danger of a problem developing. I mean, that article is at least 4 years too late. It already happened. You know, the Fed has already been too low for too long. The consequences are already going to be horrific when the Fed takes away the punch bowl, which is why they're not going to take it away. They're going to keep spiking it, and which means the ultimate consequence is going to be that much worse because of how much longer the punch bowl is going to be there.
No, exactly. And, we're starting to see some of the cracks, I think, develop here all throughout the system. The housing index is rolling over. It's done so for 4 or 5 weeks in a row consecutively. And this, I think, was a major component, an underpinning of the nascent recovery, this supposed economic recovery that we've had over the past few years.
Janet Yellen is basing her optimistic forecast on the U.S. economy in large part on the wealth effect associated with the rising real estate market. I mean, she's betting on the real estate recovery continuing as the source of the economic strength, when all the evidence already suggests that the rally is over and that it's rolling over and that now we're trending back down both in home prices and in real estate-related activity. Basically the rug is being pulled out from beneath the U.S. economy, just as the Fed is counting on that support growing. You know, because the Fed is saying, hey, we're going to stop the QE. We're going to stop buying mortgages. We're going to raise interest rates so mortgage rates go up. But if real estate is already falling now, if the market is already in decline with all the Fed's help, what's going to happen when the Fed goes from being a tailwind to a headwind?
I'd also like your comments on the new Fed chairman who has noted that we saw inflation, surpass the Fed's 2% target, but they're just not worried, apparently, about this.
I'm sure they're worried privately, but, what me worry, right? Because they have to pretend that inflation is not a problem, because otherwise they have to end QE and raise rates. So they have to continue to pretend that it's not a problem, but they also have to pretend that if it ever becomes a problem, they will act vigilantly to extinguish it, right? So they have to say, look, we don't see any inflation threat now, but trust us, if we ever do, we will quickly act, which is all the bluff, right? They can't do anything because to fight inflation, they would have to raise interest rates. They should already be doing that, but they can't do it because they would prick the bubbles in the stock market and the real estate market. We have a financial crisis worse than 2008. And so the Fed has to pretend that there's no inflation so that it doesn't have to do anything about it.
All right, let's talk about the mining shares. You've also noticed that there's some incredible opportunity opening up here. Even if gold and silver just perform well as they have, the technical situation and fundamentals are certainly looking much more positive for the precious metals mining stocks. We're even seeing divergence, a positive divergence, in the XAU-HUI relative to their underlying metals.
Yeah, the stocks have certainly been leading the recovery in 2014, which is a good sign because they led the downturn in 2013 and even earlier than that. In fact, I think all the bad news is in the gold mining companies. It's hard to find a sector that was more universally despised at the end of 2013 than the gold stocks. So there are tremendous bargains. I think anybody who's going to sell has sold. Anybody who's going to short these stocks is already short. So all we really have is new buying to come into the market, short covering to come into the market. So I really think we're headed a lot higher in the gold stocks. That's why last year, in the second half of the year, I launched my first ever gold miner fund, the Euro Pacific Gold Fund, EPGFX, I think is the symbol for my my gold fund. That's it, EPGFX, managed by Adrian Day. And I think that, you know, people really want to, you know, swing for the fences. If you're looking for something that might go up 10 times or more, I think the mining sector is the place to look. I think that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck. And certainly if I'm right on the price of gold going way up, these stocks have a long way to go because they're already factoring in a much lower gold price. So if gold goes up instead of down, there's a lot of catching up that these stocks have to do. They're basically going to get re-rated, and all of a sudden everyone's going to have to look at them in a totally different light. And I think once people get their arms around the phoniness of this economy and the false nature of the recovery, when people realize that we're going back to recession, that the Fed is going to go back to the drawing board, with more QE, that it's just going to be a perfect storm for gold. And I think the prices are just going to take off. And the key is to be invested in this sector, invested in these gold mining stocks before that happens. Because believe me, it's going to be very scary to try to chase this market once we see gold moving up in $50, $100 a day increments and we start to see these gold stocks moving up 10, 20% a day. People might be nervous about buying. So it's better to buy now, while it's quiet.
No, exactly. I mean, it does take some intestinal fortitude, but I think your thesis here is going to be proven correct. This is a momentum-driven market, and it's only going to be more so when the hedge funds and the deep pockets, start to chase after the precious metals. Not only will you have the shorts running out of their positions, but then you'll also have some very hot money, pension fund money, $3 trillion worth of pension fund money.
Yeah, and you have to realize that these pension funds and these, they have no exposure to gold mining stocks right now, zero. And so there's a lot of money out there that potentially could move into the sector. And, it doesn't take significant allocations. If you get funds deciding that, hey, we need a 5% allocation to the gold sector, I mean, that is an enormous amount of money that would be flooding into a tiny sector. And of course, as the market improves and the stocks start to go up, now you have the momentum players that are going to start, that are going to be attracted to the sector just based on the gains that they're missing out on by not being in. So it feeds on itself. And especially if we can start to see the gold stocks rising even as the general stock market is falling and people perceive now that, hey, I got to have these stocks as a hedge. Right? I got to have something that can go up when the rest of the market is going down. There's so much pent-up demand that can be unleashed for this sector.
Another component here, I mean, we see the U.S. dollar struggling for years now, trying to find its footing. Every time it looks like it's going to enter a new uptrend, it just collapses right back down. Starting to look as though some of these more wild forecasts of impending U.S. dollar collapse could occur. Do you expect this to happen abruptly, or is it just going to be more of a gradual process like we saw from the year 2000?
I guess it'll most likely be gradual until it becomes abrupt. So the answer is probably both. But, it's interesting. The dollar index, which is around 81 right now, just north of 81, all they talk talk about on the financial shows is the strength of the dollar and the dollar rally. And the dollar isn't really strong. I mean, it's not weak in that it's not collapsing, but it's really not gaining much strength. And if you look at, you know, the dollar index in the year 2000 was at 120. So we're down about a third since then. It's hard to say that 81 on the dollar index represents a strong dollar. But what the strong dollar crowd should be more concerned with is why hasn't the dollar rallied more in the last year with all of the geopolitical tensions that would normally benefit the dollar, with all of the optimism about a U.S. recovery and the end of QE and the Fed raising interest rates, with all the pessimism on Europe and all the pessimism on Japan. Why isn't the dollar index above 100? I mean, what, you know, and what that really shows me is that the fundamental weaknesses are just so dramatic that even when the dollar seems to have everything going for it, it still can't rally. And even more worrisome, if you're a dollar bull, look at what's happening with foreign central banks, particularly in the emerging markets. They have been stepping up their dollar buying to prevent the dollar from falling against their currency. So if you have an environment where you're claiming the dollar is strong, why do so many foreign central banks have to come to the dollar's rescue to artificially prop it up to prevent it from falling in an environment where it should be rising? So I think that really shows the inherent weakness in the dollar. And I think when the preponderance of the economic evidence proves my thesis correct, that we're not recovering, that in fact we're relapsing back into recession, and when the Fed is forced to come back to the economies and the markets' aid with even greater quantities of QE, I think that is going to, you know, knock this support out from beneath the dollar, and it's going to be lookout below.
All right, let's talk about some of the geopolitical risks. I personally feel that the mainline media is discounting some of the possible ramifications of the Middle East, particularly there in Iraq, as well as trouble between Israel and other nations. And then, of course, we have the Ukraine-Russia drama. I'd like to see how this factors into your analysis.
You know, I mean, it really doesn't, because I don't really understand how these geopolitical events are going to unfold. You know, obviously, there is potential there for serious problems that could be very disruptive to the global economy, that could, you know, be disruptive certainly to the U.S. and our ability to borrow and spend money. But I really don't know, you know, how it's going to end. And you don't really know what events are going to happen. I think that the greatest threats to the U.S. economy are not external, they're domestic. Although anything that would cause the world to lose confidence in the dollar and stop supporting the dollar is something that is of great concern. So if some of these conflicts hasten the dollar's demise as the world reserve currency, and certainly to the extent that, you know, we get involved in areas like the Ukraine and start pissing off Putin or other people, we start throwing weight around that we really don't have anymore. And also, you know, we've been on a rampage of fining foreign central foreign banks, whether it's France or Switzerland, and you know, now with Germany, you know, we don't give them their gold back, and we spy on Angela Merkel. I mean, we're creating a lot of problems, and I think our image and our reputation is suffering. And to the extent that these geopolitical events, continue that, America could end up losing the support that it should have already lost from foreign governments. And that's what we count on. I mean, that's what keeps our dysfunctional bubble economy going, is the fact that we fooled the whole world into supporting it for us. And they, you know, they lend us the money we need to buy things, and then they ship us the stuff that we buy on credit. So they provide us with the goods we consume, and they lend us the money to pay for it. And, you know, that's the secret to our success, is, you know, the world's foolishness in propping us up. So some of these events that we're seeing may hasten the world waking up and coming to the conclusion that continuing this scheme is not in their best interest. I mean, it's never been in their best interest, but they just have to come to terms with that.
Give people an idea on what you see with regard to this amazing equities rally we've seen. You know, the Dow Jones at its, 118-year all-time record high, almost weekly now. were having record closes?
If you price the Dow in gold, it's nowhere near its record high. So, you know, you're pricing it in terms of U.S. dollars, which themselves are losing a lot of value. So it's not, you know, a really significant rally. But what's fueling it is the Fed. I mean, the fact that the market is going up, despite the fact that the economic fundamentals are deteriorating, that makes, you know, it makes the bubble bigger because stocks should be going down. Instead, they're going up. And so, you know, the price of stocks versus the value, that gap keeps getting wider and wider. And what's supporting it is share buybacks that are being made possible by low interest rates. It's the fact that corporations can have such low payments on their debt. They can buy back shares and reduce the number of shares outstanding. And their customers can rely on cheap credit to buy their products. So that also drives their top line. So I think the entire stock market is built on the foundation of cheap money. And if that foundation is removed, the market's going to come crashing down in a very spectacular way. But if that foundation is not removed because the Fed doesn't want to have that happen, then it's the dollar that's going to come crashing down in a spectacular way. And, you know, even if the stock market goes up, the question is, will it go up enough to compensate for the loss of value of the dollar? And for most people, I think the answer is no.
No, exactly. And, you know, we're still seeing the erosion of purchasing power, which, of course, is an indirect effect from the scenario you've laid out here. Just when will the masses of people, when will the hoi polloi wake up to what's going on? They obviously see their paychecks and purchasing power declining. They're seeing cost of goods and services, groceries and whatnot, moving up steadily year after year.
The masses are not in the stock market right now. I mean, they're too broke to buy stocks. And they already are appreciating the fact that their lives are getting worse, that the American dream is becoming more and more elusive for them, that their circumstances, their personal circumstances are deteriorating. You know, their job doesn't pay as much as it used to. Their bills are mounting. Things cost more. Their electric bills are higher. Their food bills are higher. Their medical costs are higher. So the mass has already experienced this. The question is, you know, when are the investors, when are the top 1% or 5%, whoever's still, you know, prospering in this bubble economy, when are they going to come to their senses? When are they going to figure out that this whole thing is a charade? Because I think a lot of people in the middle class, they are, you know, they don't buy all this nonsense about a recovery. I mean, you look at the polls, and a lot of people still think it's a recession. And they're the ones that are right. It's the so-called experts that still don't understand. They're the ones that have been taken in by the con of this, you know, mirage of a recovery. So, you know, when are they going to figure it out? And for the majority, it's going to be too late. I mean, it's going to have to be a collapse. But when did people figure out there was a housing bubble? Most investors figured out there's a housing bubble after it burst. I mean, way after it burst. I mean, the whole thing had imploded. You know, Fannie Mae was broke by the time the masses acknowledged, yeah, I guess we had a housing bubble. You know, so the same thing is going to happen this time around. The vast majority of investors are going to remain clueless until they've lost most of their money. Then they'll figure it out.
Well, not to mention we have the foxes guarding the hen house. I mean, we had Henry Paulson, who was one of the architects of the housing boom vis-a-vis the derivatives there, the mortgage-backed securities, CDOs, swaps, and whatnot. So, I mean, when you have this interconnection between Wall Street and Capitol Hill.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's even worse when it comes to the Federal Reserve because, you know, the Federal Reserve was the primary architect of the housing bubble. It was their cheap money that inflated it. Yeah, the government played a part by guaranteeing mortgages and the tax code and all that. But the principal architect was the Fed. And then as a result of the financial crisis, right, that was a consequence of the Fed's mistakes, the Federal Reserve was given even more power to protect us from the next crisis, even though we need protection from the Fed. And by giving the Fed more power, they didn't work to make sure that we didn't have another crisis. They guaranteed that the next crisis would be that much worse.
Exactly. $700 billion or else. The irony there is that nothing has changed. It's actually gotten worse. We didn't go back to the Stiegel Act. Now we have Dodd-Frank.
No, nothing has gotten better. The only thing we've managed to do is partially reflate the bubbles, and everybody looks at that as a sign of success. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is. They say, oh, we got the stock market back up, we got the bond market and the housing market back up, so everything has worked. No, it hasn't worked. Propping up home prices is not part of the solution. Propping up home prices was part of the problem. We need to let home prices fall to the point where they're affordable by regular Americans who can use their savings for a down payment. The only people that can buy houses right now are highly leveraged hedge funds. The home ownership is at a 20-year low among, you know, actual families. I mean, first-time home buyers, too. It's all-time record lows. So we need lower home prices. The reason that people can't afford to buy their first home is because the prices are too high. The market would want to correct the problem by bringing prices down. But the government distorts the economy and worsens the problem by artificially propping them up. And by doing it, it's diverting resources away from where they need to be and putting them where they shouldn't be. And all of this is undermining the economy. It's why we're not creating real jobs. It's why we don't have any legitimate economic growth. It's why we have this increasing divide between the very rich and the very poor. It's Fed policy that is responsible, that is driving all these trends, and it needs to be reversed.
But I'd still point to fiscal irresponsibility because, look, we have shifted virtually 90% of the residential home mortgage market into these government-sponsored enterprises.
Remember, the fiscal irresponsibility is a function of the Fed. If the Fed was not buying up all the government debt, if the Fed wasn't buying up all these mortgages, we couldn't afford to be fiscally irresponsible because nobody would lend us the money. So the only thing that is driving the big deficit spending is the Fed. If the Fed acted independently and did its job and refused to participate in this, refused to monetize government debt, right, if they really acted like an independent central bank, then we would have a much smaller federal government today. But because the Federal Reserve is cooperating with the government in enabling the deficits and enabling this enormous growth of government, that is the problem. And as long as the Fed has got interest rates at zero, as long as they're willing to print money and buy government bonds, then there's no reason for the government to stop borrowing. They're not going to stop borrowing until they run into some negative consequences as a result of the borrowing. But if the Fed is postponing all the negative consequences, why on earth would any politician risk not getting reelected by cutting spending when they can spend whatever they want without any negative consequences because the Fed is there protecting them?
This trouble you speak of, I mean, it really harkens back to the fractional reserve banking system, which is founded falsely on this idea of, you know, creating money out of thin air.
I have no problem with fractional reserve banking without government interference. I mean, we were on a fractional reserve system before the Federal Reserve. I mean, when people took their gold to a bank and deposited, banks didn't keep 100% gold reserves behind the notes that they issued. So there was always a balance. I mean, private bankers need to have a reserve ratio that works. I mean, they have to instill confidence in their depositors that they have enough gold on hand to meet any demands, but they still want to maximize profits and, you know, so that they can pay higher interest rates to their depositors on the gold that they're storing. So there's always going to be some kind of fractional reserve banking in a free market. But I think the free market will find a stable ratio that works. But what happens is the government comes in and insures all the deposits and says no matter how highly leveraged your bank is, no matter how little reserves they have behind the deposits, we're going to protect those deposits in case there's a run. That's the problem. It's the government-guaranteed bank accounts that is the reason that we have this, you know, the fraction that we hold as a reserve is so tiny. You know, in a free market, we would have fractional reserve banking, but the fraction of that was held on reserve would be much, much higher than what exists under the government system. And I don't necessarily think that that is an unhealthy free market development. And especially when you have the banks differentiate between demand deposits, right, which they don't loan out because they're available on demand, and a time deposit where you buy a CD, where you buy a CD that doesn't mature for 5 years, why should the bank sit on that money for 5 years? Why can't it lend it out, right? Especially when you've told the bank, I don't want my money for 5 years. So that, you know, you have to have a differentiation. And we used to, but today the banks treat all deposits as if they're the same. They don't care if it's a time deposit or a demand deposit. They lend it right out.
Yeah, but that's really a function of the fact that there's just nothing underlying money in general. I mean, I agree with you. If we go back to the days of the goldsmith, sure, you had at least some substance underlying your currency. But in 1971, we eliminated that altogether, the vestiges. So, I mean, that really puts us in a position where the house of cards just continues to build and build and build, but inevitably it's going to have to implode. And, you know, as we wrap up here, Peter Schiff, I wonder if you could give people an idea of how much they need to be invested. What would the typical investor who's had some nice gains in bonds and stocks over the past decade or so, what fraction of their portfolio should they invest in the miners and in underlying precious metals, please?
At least 10%, if not 20 to 25%, I think should be in physical gold and in the mining sector, especially given how cheap the sector is right now. Once we get a significant rally, you might, you know, pare off your position a little bit. But given the incredibly low valuations right now, you really need to have, I believe, you know, an overweight position in that sector. I think it's one of the only sectors that I think can deliver those type of, you know, extraordinary gains going from where we are right now. But I also think that investors should really be divesting themselves of U.S. dollar-denominated investments. I mean, they really shouldn't be in the bond market. They shouldn't be, whether it's corporate, treasuries, muni market. They shouldn't even be in the U.S. stock market in general. They should be looking abroad. They should be looking at the developing markets, the markets where there's a lot of good valuations. And you have to realize that if, you know, I'm right on the dollar collapsing relative to other currencies, not just losing value in terms of purchasing power, but losing value in an exchange rate, I mean, losing value, you know, to other currencies, then what's going to happen in the world is a realignment of relative wealth and global purchasing power, where Americans are going to get a lot poorer and people in certain countries are going to get a lot richer, because the production, the factories that are exist in the world, they're not going anywhere. I mean, they're still here. They're still going to produce. The difference is who is going to be able to afford to buy the output from those factories. And I think in the future, Americans are not going to afford much of it because they're going to be outbid by the foreigners. I mean, right now we're outbidding a lot of people in emerging markets because of the relative value of our currency versus theirs. But if the dollar plunges against these other currencies, then the tables are turned. Now, foreigners outbid Americans. And so now Americans have to go without stuff. And now foreigners get to take their turn at consuming. And especially since it's their factories that are doing the producing, you would figure that it's only natural that they should get to consume what they produce. And we, you know, Americans will be left with nothing. And so, but the way to position yourself for this transition is to invest in those countries, own the currencies that are going to go up as the dollar goes down, be invested in companies that are going to be catering to consumers, customers, who are going to be much wealthier in the future than they are right now. I think there's a tremendous amount of money to be made by people who can act in advance of this dynamic shift that we're about to experience in the world. I mean, it's a big change in the global pecking order. America was on top. I don't know if we're going to go all the way to the bottom, but we're going to sink a lot lower than we are now, and people have to understand that, and they have to be positioned for that. You know, there was a lot of money made betting on America in the 19th century when we were a rising power. Well, now there's going to be a lot of money made betting against it. Unfortunately, that's the bet you have to make. The people who are still betting on America don't understand how dramatically America has changed, right? We're not the country we used to be. We're not this bastion of free market capitalism. We don't have sound money and limited government. We're a socialist state. We're a bankrupt state. We have enormous debts. And people have to understand that really the only thing that's been standing between us and complete collapse is the ignorance of the rest of the world, who still loans us money as if nothing has changed, as if we were still the wealthy Bretton Woods economy that, you know, that existed at the end of the Second World War.
I know it's not going to be a popular comment, but I mean, I listened to one pundit point out over the weekend that we could very well be one of the, if not the most socialist countries in the world now. You know, the irony I see there is that China, which was, the quintessential communist country.
It's capitalism. It's economic freedom. And in many respects, the Chinese enjoy greater economic freedom than do Americans. And, of course, there's lots of other countries. I mean, you can argue right now that, we're the least free country, certainly in North America. I think there's more freedom in Canada and Mexico, actually, than the United States. There's plenty of countries in South America, Chile, Peru, where the level of economic freedom is significantly greater than it is in the United States. But also, if you look at the direction that we're going, and we're going, unfortunately, very rapidly in the wrong direction, but the pendulum is swinging away from freedom to statism, to socialism. Other countries, the pendulum is swinging in the other direction because they started off with lots of socialism, and now they're moving away from it because it's so bad, because they realized from experience how bad it is, and so they're trying to move in the opposite direction. And so, yeah, it's a very, very scary time to be in the U.S. It's dangerous to be investing here. But I'm hopeful that after we have this complete economic implosion that's coming, that maybe we'll learn our lesson. Maybe it can be the catalyst to get that pendulum going back in the other direction. I'm certainly going to do everything I can to push it in the other direction. And I'm trying to help as many Americans as I can now protect their wealth. I think that's the key, that, we have to have Americans who don't go down with this ship, who get their money invested abroad, who buy these foreign stocks that I think are going to do so well, that invest in precious metals and mining stocks. That's what I'm trying to help people do at Euro Pacific Capital, at Euro Pacific Precious Metals, is getting people out of dollars and into the right assets so that they don't go broke. And I think that if you preserve or enhance your wealth, you're going to be in a much better position to be a positive force in trying to change the course of this country and get it moving back into the right direction, and also providing the capital. Because if we're going to regrow this economy, we need capital. We need savings. We need to be able to repatriate our money and bring it back from abroad, use some of our gold to put it back into productive investments here in the United States.
Well, you have to stop frightening capital. There was an interesting study done, studied all the empires beginning way before the Roman Empire up into the United States. And he noted several commonalities, about seven. One of them in particular, they last about 250 years. Here we are at about 240 years into our empire. And they always begin with pioneers, as we saw, our pioneers heading, go west, young man. You'll remember that cliche. Eventually, it ends up, and this is fascinating, decadence, debased currency, political elite at the top trying to do everything they can to skim what they can get to line their own pockets. And keep in mind, this is every single empire.
Yeah, and apart from the decadence, I guess, that's okay. Yeah, the rest of it is all bad stuff. Decadence is the fun part.
There you go. All right. Well, I'm not going to argue with you there on that bit of levity. Let's wrap up the show here. Peter Schiff, please tell folks more about the services you provide.
Yeah, well, we provide a full array of financial services, brokerage and managed accounts through my U.S. broker dealer, Euro Pacific Capital, Euro Pacific Asset Management. People can go to europac.net, europac.net. If you want to buy physical precious metals and you don't want to get ripped off, you don't want to pay a big markup, my gold company is shiffgold.com is the URL. Easy to remember, just my last name, shiffgold.com. For anybody listening who's not an American, if you're lucky enough to live in another country, you can work with me through my bank at Europac Bank, Europac Bank, BANK.com. We provide all these services that we do in America through the bank, including the gold and silver backed debit cards, which I wish we can offer those in the States. We can't, but we do offer them offshore for people who want to have, immediate access to their gold and silver via, the debit, a Master or Visa card system. So it really makes it easy for you to put yourself on a gold or silver standard, whichever you want. And remember, my bank is 100% reserve bank. So we talked about fractional reserve banking. We have 100% reserves at my bank, so nothing is loaned out. All the income that we generate at the bank is fee-based. So it's not, we're not making any loans. We're not doing anything with your deposits. So that's Europac Bank. And again, people want to follow me, go to my YouTube channel at Schiff Report. Listen to me on the radio at the website for my radio show. What I do every day is Schiff Radio, schiffradio.com. So check it out. I mean, I'm doing, doing a show Monday through Friday, 2 hours a day. If you can't listen live, you can listen whenever. We keep replaying the show until the next show comes on.
Excellent. Keep up the great work.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Chris. This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A MarketWatch.com article this week actually devoted Digital Inc. to discussing not the release of former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan's book, The Map and the Territory, which was actually released in October of 2013, but rather the upcoming paperback release of the same book due out this fall. In an effort to make the paperback release of Greenspan's book newsworthy and relevant, the article did a Q&A with Greenspan with the disclaimer that it was, quote, edited for length and clarity. Thinking back over Greenspan's tenure as Fed chairman from 1987 to 2006, I wish we had a mechanism where we could have edited his comments over those years for length and clarity. But instead, we were exposed to the creation of what became known as Fed speak, which was nothing more than linguistic puzzles with veiled double and triple meanings that commentators and policy experts made careers interpreting for the masses, and unfortunately, being taken seriously in the process. People forget too conveniently the day that Greenspan gave his Fed update during the housing boom, where he discussed the merits of homeowners refinancing into short-term adjustable-rate mortgages. That's the day 5 out of 6 chambers were loaded in the revolver in the ultimate game of Russian roulette. The housing crash and the 2008 financial collapse was sealed that day. He had convinced the best and the brightest he was right, and his policies and proclamations were correct. One of my speaking clients at the time, the vice president of engineering for a Fortune 500 company, told me that he considered Alan Greenspan and the Fed the fourth branch of government. How did Sir Alan Greenspan get such a reputation? Why does the media still approach him with such kid gloves? It requires a mini history lesson. Alan Greenspan was a disciple of philosopher Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged, a book that has come in only second to the Holy Bible in terms of its impact on people's lives. Greenspan was part of Rand's inner circle. Rand's views on religion limited widespread acceptance of her philosophy. However, Rand's views on economics were cutting edge, focused on the individual over the collective, and were critical to the advancement of society. Because Greenspan was part of Rand's inner circle on the economic front, leading politicians of the 1980s, including Ronald Reagan, Jack Kemp, and others who endorsed Greenspan at the time, the unspoken implication of that time, and throughout his tenure as Fed chairman, was that the U.S. was indirectly and covertly going to benefit from the power of Ayn Rand's economic ideas through Alan Greenspan, who could stick handle a paper fiat system better than anyone, especially with his background and dissertation supporting the gold standard. In effect, the financial world always had in the back of their mind that here is this financial objectivist, gold standard guy named Greenspan, managing a paper fiat system. We've got the best of all worlds. Boy, did they get fooled. And so did we. At least those who listened to and believed Greenspan. Some still want to believe. But that's hard to do when Greenspan answers questions today like he does this. When he was asked, "What was your reaction to Fed Chairwoman Yellen's speech at the IMF, where she said the central bank would use regulation first if there were concerns about asset prices?" Greenspan responded, "There is a fundamental distinction. I happen to agree that bubbles are primarily an issue to be addressed by regulation." When he was asked, "As the Fed is looking at the exit, do you think we can get through this without upsetting the economy?" he responded, "I certainly hope so. I certainly think they will, but it's going to be difficult." He was asked, "Do you expect a sharp market reaction to the first hike?" he said, "Of course. Look what happened when the first indication of tapering occurred. Markets have always been sensitive. They reflect animal spirits." Here we go again. Same song, second verse. Bubbles are solved by regulation. Rate hike reactions will reflect animal spirits. I'd like to see Greenspan answer real questions. Like what he meant, really meant when he said, "The Federal Reserve will continue to lease gold in increasing quantities should the price rise." We could spend an hour on that topic alone with Greenspan and drill down in question after question. What I'd really like to see is Chris Powell from GATA and Alan Greenspan alone on a stage for 60 minutes with no interruptions. That would be a conversation that would change the course of history. If Alan really wanted to provide a legacy for future generations, that would be the kind of conversation he would have. But in all likelihood, that is not going to happen. All we're going to get is some more Fed speak and an ability to buy an autographed soft cover copy of a book that is now 1 year old. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.